Okay, there's lying, and then there's lying to Perry Mason.
Are you trying to shield someone, Mr. Byrd? Is that the reason you lied about hearing that shot when Miss Wallace was in the room?
No, I... All right, I did lie about that.
And it was you who called her on the telephone and induced her to come to your room. Yes.
Why would anyone lie to Perry Mason? A bigger question is, why do people exaggerate and conceal the simplest things? Our pants are on fire. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Very clever. Good morning. It's Tuesday, June 24th, and get ready. Freakonomist Stephen Dubner is here to explain why you lie. Prepare to be infuriated. Prepare to be outraged by the extent of the housing downturn in America. A look at Nigeria in the global energy crosshairs. Sending veterans to school after Iraq and Afghanistan. How does it compare with the GI Bill? That and all the news. The UN Security Council has unanimously condemned violence in Zimbabwe against the party seeking to unseat longtime President Robert Mugabe. Opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai praised the resolution.
I think it's a very important resolution. It recognizes the people who are accountable for the violence and squarely places that responsibility of Mr. Mugabe's leadership. How he's going to take it, we don't know.
Tsvangirai announced he was withdrawing the election on Sunday. Since then, he's taken refuge at the Dutch embassy in Harare. U.S. officials say 4 Americans and 6 Iraqi civilians have been killed in an explosion in Baghdad's Shiite Sadr City district. Officials are blaming Shiite extremists for the attack.
More than 800 wildfires are still burning in Northern California, many sparked by lightning over the weekend. One blaze in the Shasta Trinity National Forest threatens about 1,200 homes. Divers in the Philippines have made their way into an upside-down ferry boat to find only bodies. The vessel capsized in a typhoon on Saturday. A U.S. Navy ship is joining the search for survivors. Only 40 passengers out of the 800 people on board have been found alive. U.S. Undersecretary of State John Negroponte.
We want to express our condolences to the government and the people of the Philippines, particularly the family members.
The U.S. State Department has made a donation to the Philippines Red Cross.
It's been 20 years since top NASA scientist James Hansen first told the Senate about global warming. Yesterday, two decades later, he told a panel that without drastic action to reduce greenhouse gases, quote, we're toast. Hansen says it's just a matter of years before we start seeing drastic changes like mass extinction and ecosystem collapse.
And he's not lying. No, that's what we're talking about, though, this day on The Takeaway at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Why do you lie? What do you lie about? Particularly things that there's no reason to lie about. We're going to be talking about that with Stephen Dubner a little bit later.
Or even against your self-interest.
I would never lie about this. The S&P 500 stands at 1318 in trading today. I would never lie about that.
And in Asia, oil prices held steady at nearly $137 a barrel.
That's also true. But we don't want your truth. We want your lies today on The Takeaway. 877-8-MY-TAKE. Or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. It's a question. Is the party over in home ownership in America? How home ownership has caused the U.S. economy to hurt rather significantly. We're going to be talking about a Harvard study that just shows how much pain there is in the U.S. economy regarding real estate. There's no party on Capitol Hill regarding housing, though. They're trying to push a $300 billion housing rescue bill in the Senate at the same time as there are ethics investigations into the mortgage dealings of some of the Democratic leaders pushing that bill. Joining us now is Todd Zwillick, who can explain this much better than I can right now. He covers the Hill for Capital News Connection in Washington, D.C. Todd, let's begin with the bill itself. $300 billion. Is it buying time for homeowners? Is it cash payments for homeowners? It's a pretty complicated bill. Could you lay it out for us, please?
Yeah. Yes, yes, and yes. It's buying time, it's complicated, and it's cash. But don't be misled. The $300 billion is a number that gets thrown around a little bit. There's not actually $300 billion of taxpayer money in this bill. There's $300 billion of loan guarantees. It would allow the FHA, the Federal Housing Administration, to back $300 billion worth of new loans for people who are being foreclosed upon. The cost of that is somewhere in the neighborhood of $2 or $3 billion or $4 billion. So that $300 billion number, I mean, the numbers in this bill are scary, but they're not quite that scary.
Well, if you're a homeowner and facing foreclosure, that's pretty scary. How much time does this buy you if you're an FHA mortgage holder?
Well, it really depends on how big your loan is. It's really all about how much your house is worth. What this bill does is increases the limits under which you can qualify for an FHA loan. I think it boosts it up to somewhere in the neighborhood of the $600,000 loans in most areas of the country will now qualify. So people who would have been considered too high of income or had houses that were too valuable before now can qualify for government-backed loans.
Thanks for setting us straight on that, Todd. That's actually now I finally understand it for the first time. What is the bigger obstacle to this bill, though, a presidential veto or the ethics investigation that seems to center around Senator Christopher Dodd, who's the chairman of the Senate Banking Committee?
Yeah, well, first on Chairman Dodd, Portfolio Magazine, published by Condé Nast, came out with a report last week in which they said that Dodd and another powerful senator, Senator Kent Conrad, had both gotten VIP loans from Countrywide Financial. Now, Countrywide is a discount mortgage lender, one of the biggest in the country. They're safe to sort of think of them as kind of the Enron of mortgage lending right now.
Well, they're a subsidiary of Bank of America right now, or at least almost.
Yes, indeed. Going to be bought up for a fraction of the price of what they used to be worth, as a matter of fact. Senator Dodd got a VIP loan in which he was given a friends and family rate by Countrywide. Now, he originally said when he was first asked about it that he knew nothing about it, didn't know about it. It's news to him. By the end of, I believe, last Thursday when he spoke to reporters live on Capitol Hill, he said, oh, I did know about it. Yes, I remember. I did get a VIP rate. It had nothing to do with – I just thought it was a courtesy because we had two loans with that company, not because I'm a senator.
Is that going to derail the bill? And what is the presidential veto situation in the few seconds we have here?
Yeah, that's not going to derail the bill. What's going to derail the bill is what's called a SAP here in Washington. That's a statement of administration policy, otherwise known as the veto threat, which was very strongly worded from the White House last week. There's a lot of stuff in this bill that they don't like. So that's there is an ethics investigation underway, but that's not what's driving the death of this bill right now. It's really the White House.
Well, it's still a cliffhanger for you mortgage holders. Todd Zwillick, thank you very much for joining us.
Always a pleasure.
Todd Zwillick is a reporter for Capital News Connection and host of the Power Breakfast from Capitol Hill.
And now the numbers are in. The State of the Nation's housing report is out from Harvard University, and none of it is good. Nicholas Retsinas, good morning.
Good morning.
Who's in the most trouble?
Well, it's a long list, but clearly at the top of the list are the more than a million homeowners who are losing their home or have lost their home. They are clearly suffering the most.
Nicholas Retsinas is the director of the Joint Housing Studies at Harvard University. Your latest survey, what does it show, Nicholas?
Not a lot of good news. As we all know, we are in the throes of a housing market downturn. The report documents that by many perspectives, it is the most severe downturn in a generation. While we've seen at other times drop off in sales and starts, it's very unusual that it's been correlated with such a large national home price decline.
And there's one number that really sticks out, which is nearly 9 million Americans are spending more than half of their income on housing. How do you explain that?
Well, it is in some ways the worst of both worlds. You have a falling housing, downward slumping housing market where prices are falling. But at the same time, as our economy continues to produce low-wage jobs, people are finding it increasingly difficult to pay to find housing that is affordable. And as you point out, a record number are paying a disproportionate amount of their income for either rent or mortgages.
Okay, let's talk about all these numbers. Home foreclosures have doubled the past year, and by nearly every measurement, home sales down, home prices down, home values down, lots of numbers. What's the bottom line?
Well, first of all, it's a big country, so most of the country is suffering. There are some pockets that are doing okay. The bottom line is we built too many homes, and we cannot now sell those homes, which is lowering the price. At the same time, anybody who might have been interested in buying a home doesn't have access to credit. Credit is constrained as a result of the subprime debacle over a year ago. So the end result is we can't seem to dig our way out of this, at least in the short term.
Well, you know, the thing that is so striking to me is that for most of my adult life, I've been told that home ownership is the center of your economic security, is the basis for, your wealth as you imagine getting older. And it seems from looking at these statistics that that has reversed almost overnight, and that owning a home is now akin to economic suicide. It's one of the dumbest things you can do. Am I reading something wrong here?
Well, you may be overreading it a bit, but it is a wake-up call that owning a home is not a riskless investment. It's not an investment where you're guaranteed to make money always sort of over time. Over the long run, it has been an important source of wealth creation. But in a sense, over the last few years, we overinvested in housing. And as a result, we overbuilt. And as a result, the basic laws of supply and demand lead to lower prices.
Nicholas.
So a lot of people who thought that they had owned a home, in fact, were just renting a home because they really weren't paying off a mortgage anyway.
Oh, that's interesting, because you're not improving your equity, right?
Exactly.
Now, Nicholas, you said there are some parts of the country that are doing better than others. Can you tell us where there is some good news?
Well, pockets in the Pacific Northwest, though even that's beginning to slow, parts of the Carolina, parts of Texas, in that case related somewhat to the increase in oil prices. So there are pockets, there are communities, but more and more metropolitan areas are seeing price declines, with more likely to come.
And why did you say that those areas are managing to sustain in a way that others are not?
A couple of different reasons. One, their local economies are still pretty solid, pretty strong. Secondly, they did not engage in the overbuilding that other parts of the country. For example, look at the Southwest, Las Vegas and Phoenix. Over the decade, they almost doubled the number of homes they built, and increasingly they sold those homes to investors. That was a recipe for disaster.
Is there any indication from the regional data that you have of how we're going to come out of this as a nation? Any community that sort of tells the story of how we're all going to emerge from this if we do anytime soon?
Well, no, because it's too big a country, because there really are very, very different housing markets. But we suspect, as we look at the data, that, let's say, the Northeast is probably likely to come out of it before the Southwest, because there wasn't that overbuilding, the Northeast being essentially fully developed. Other parts of the country, let's say the Midwest, the story there is not so much an overheated housing market, but it is a crumbling economy. So its prospects for long-term recovery are much more suspect.
Thanks, Nicholas, for explaining all of that. Nicholas Retsinas, the director of the Joint Center for Housing Studies of Harvard University. We've asked listeners to respond, and this is what one person had to say about their housing experience.
Hi, it's Dave. I'm calling from my car. My wife and I were married back in 1999. We bought our first condo back then. Turned it around in a year and made about $50,000 on it, and then bought a house down in Connecticut that we turned around in a couple of years and basically doubled our money. We've had our house, the current house that we bought, probably overbought at this point, on the market for a year, and we're jumping through hoops right now to try and sell it. It's been one demoralizing cut after another. We basically grew up in the housing boom, at least our adult lives so far, and we're paying the price now.
Great story. Here's another one from Rich on Long Island. We happen to be the beneficiaries of the housing downturn last year. We were able to buy up on our very same block a house that was originally offered at about $200,000. It came down $100,000, and we were able to purchase that house. Now we're happily in this new house just down the street where we were. There's a song to that effect.
So many stories.
Great stories.
So many stories.
Thanks for helping us to take the pulse of America on housing. We're going to talk about lying when we come back. 877-8-MY-TAKE. We'll be right back.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everybody. We asked for lies, of course, and you did not disappoint at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Bridget says, I lie quite a bit just to save time and be polite. Example question, are you a vegetarian? Lie, yes. Real answer, not really. I don't like most meat because I didn't eat it growing up because we were really poor, and now I don't digest it well and it gives me a stomach ache. People lie for the freaky... Oh, did I say freak? Yes. That's why we invited Freakonomics author and our Freakonomics friend, Stephen Dubner, here. Stephen, people lie for the craziest reasons. You can hear just in those emails right there. What have you discovered?
They do. Well, it makes sense that people would lie. You know, you were talking about the housing market. Lying was a huge component of the housing bubble. Huge. Yeah. On all sides.
Lying to your bank.
You lie to your bank. Your bank lies to the packager, right? The packager lies to the investors. That's a part of it. Now, those are lies we're used to. Those are lies for advantage. Someone wants to get something better than they're due. But if you think about it, there are a lot of reasons we lie. We lie for advantage. We might lie to get out of trouble. We might lie to get out of an obligation that we don't want. But one of the weirdest ones I've ever seen that we see pretty regularly is a lie of reputation. In other words, you lie to change your reputation in the eyes of someone else, even when the stakes are incredibly low. So the very low-cost example I would use is this. Have you ever been in a dinner party and someone starts talking about a book and all the heads around the table start nodding? Yeah, I read it. Did you read it? Yeah, I read it. And you know that 80% of them have never read the book. Why do people do that? Well, they want to look better in the eyes, in the eyes of the other people that they're sitting with. But sometimes a lie of reputation is even weirder, and that's what I've written about. This Mexican welfare program called Oportunidades, and it's about it's a huge program in Mexico. And some scholars who studied it found that people will lie about the stuff in their house, what they own or what they don't own. Sometimes they overreport stuff, and sometimes they underreport stuff. The underreporting is not that surprising. You would expect that people might not admit to having things like satellite TV or a new truck if they want to get in the welfare program.
I see.
What's shocking, however, is the stuff that they overreport. They say that they have things that they don't actually have. A toilet, for instance, tap water, a gas stove, concrete floor, and refrigerator. These are things that in large percentages people are telling a welfare clerk that they do have when in fact they don't. And the scholars who did this amazingly interesting study concluded that it was basically to avoid shame.
Well, yeah, that makes sense.
It makes sense if you're not trying to get money from a welfare program.
That's what I was about to say. So basically you're lying against your own self-interest. You're saying that you have all of these things, which perhaps could make it less likely that you get these welfare benefits.
Exactly. And it's a very substantial benefit. The benefit averages about 25% of a poor family's monthly expenditures. It's a big pile of money sitting there to be gotten. And yet, people have such a hard time admitting face-to-face to a clerk that, no, I don't have running water. No, I don't have a concrete floor, and so on. So what's fascinating about this is not just this welfare program, although let me take a step back and say what I think is amazing about this study is economists always talk about people's declared preferences and their revealed preferences. Declared preferences are what you say you have or what you say you want, how you say you're going to vote, for instance, what you say you believe in. Mm-hmm. And your revealed preferences are what you actually do.
I do as I say, not as I do.
Exactly. Exactly. It's very hard sometimes to see how people actually behave because you can't peer into their homes, you can't peer into their hearts, you can't peer into their minds. In this case, however, they did. The data is remarkable because they had the information on what the people said to the clerks, but then when people were accepted into the program, there were follow-up visits into the home. Hmm. So you actually had two sets of data.
Well, let's look at the data then. What is the percentage of people being untruthful just as a raw number about anything? Was anybody absolutely truthful?
Oh, sure. Some are.
But it's a minority.
Well, you know what? Honestly, I'd have to sit down and really tease out the numbers. Yes, it is going to be a minority. Almost everybody lies about something.
That's interesting.
Right. Which, again, you wouldn't...
I love the book Freakonomics, by the way.
Hey, thanks, John.
Great book. Really great
that.
Read.
That's a yeah. royalty,
excellent
too.
Excellent read.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. And I bought it, too. I actually bought it.
I did read it.
I
what are you saying, Dora?
I'm just saying, and we can extrapolate from the information that you're talking about. You bring to us also another study, an Australian medical study, where doctors self-reported their hand washing rate at 73%. However,
yeah, the actual
this is doctors.
So this is great.
God.
Doctors in Australia self-reported, as you just said, Adora, 73% hand hygiene rate working in a hospital when they were under self-reported restrictions. In other words, here we're going to have a study. We need to make sure everybody's washing hands to prevent bacterial infection, to prevent needless deaths, which
is
a big
huge problem. Yeah.
Huge problem. And I could talk for hours about that, so don't get me started. But the same hospital, at the time that those doctors were asked to self-report their data, they recruited a bunch of nurses as spies to spy on the actual docs who said they washed 73% of the time. Their actual observed rate was 9%.
Oh,
so you go from 3 out of 4 people who say they do it to 1 out of 10 who do. Again,
I wonder if those doctors actually had toilets at home. Yeah.
Well, probably fewer than said they did, right.
Oh, that's...
I hate to use the word lie over and over again because it's more subtle than that, but it's important
exaggerate.
It's important. We are not our own best judge of our own data. Let's put it that way.
Self-reporting is suspect. That's for sure. At the very least, Stephen Dubner, we're going to keep you right here. Hold on there. Adora, we have some responses
we
online.
We do. DB wrote to us, when I'm horrendously late for somewhere, the airport, for instance, I lied to the taxi driver and told him that my flight was later than it actually was. I can't believe that I actually value what some stranger who I will never see again. I value their opinion about my time management over maybe, I don't know, driving faster.
Now, more headlines from Femi. Okay.
28 minutes past the hour. The U.S. Navy is helping to recover hundreds of bodies from a capsized ferry in the Philippines. The Senate will take up a $300 billion homeowner rescue plan geared towards people facing foreclosure. And the IRS says it's raising the mileage rate for businesses to help companies cope with the high cost of gas. Now to your news in some more detail. Towns along the Mississippi River are filling thousands of sandbags to try and stop the swollen Mississippi River from flooding. Volunteers in Lincoln County, Missouri, are fortifying their levee with 50,000 sandbags. Just to the north of them, the town of Foley is already underwater. A government study says that brain injuries account for half of all elderly people's deaths after a fall. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention study is said to be the first comprehensive national look at the role brain injuries play in deadly elderly falls. The U.S. Olympic basketball team has been announced. The NBA's most valuable player, Kobe Bryant, made the cut. Carmelo Anthony and Jason Kidd are some of the other big names going to Beijing. And coach Mike Krzyzewski is hoping to do better than the Athens games when the U.S. basketball team came third. Have a quick listen to this. Tell me what you really think. No fibbing, please. Okay, Adora is grimacing. That's Celine Dion covering the AC/DC's hit You Shook Me All Night Long. Voted by Total Guitar as the world's worst cover version ever.
I would agree.
AC/DC is kind of a classic, and sometimes it's better just to leave them alone.
But she tried.
Yeah, Celine Dion ruins every song she tries
to
cover.
Oh, that's so not true.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, now featuring Father's Day, a short film about a woman whose father left her when she was a child, and her daughter, who now wants to meet her estranged grandfather, if he lives long enough. Available at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. It's Tuesday. It's June 24th. We're asking about the little tales that you tell, sometimes not necessarily in your best interest. Who are you lying to and why? Also, the housing crisis in America. What's your housing story? Drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can write to us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Nigeria, John, important to the oil industry?
Oh, massively.
Very important. What's happening there today in Nigeria has a lot to do with gas prices at your pump. It's the fourth largest exporter to the U.S., but continued militant attacks on Nigerian pipelines has triggered major shortages. They're down more than 20% in production the last year. But today, the militants have agreed to a ceasefire. Carol Ahoya reports for the Financial Times. Good morning, Carol. This ceasefire, it gonna hold?
That's the million-dollar question. I'm relatively pessimistic. I think the fundamentals of Nigeria are still very poor. I don't think any of the grievances really can be turned around in any short period of time. And we've witnessed years of these kind of issues. So, yes, I think maybe it'll hold for a little while, but I don't think that you'll be able to turn around the situation in Nigeria that has caused these attacks in the short term.
Carol, what I don't understand is Nigeria has been a poor country for a long time with rich oil reserves. Why have the militants been so potent, particularly in the past couple of months?
Well, as the oil price goes up, the interruption of any kind of oil supply, in particular in this tight market, becomes a bigger news story, a bigger issue. So the power of the militants has increased. If we'd had lots of extra oil to put on the market, if the Saudis were able to just say, right, you know, you've lost some oil from Nigeria, but we'll just fill that gap for you, that would be one thing. You wouldn't see an immediate impact in the price and front page stories on the Financial Times. So I think the militants are very aware of their newfound power.
And as you just noted, you're talking about headlines. Obviously, the oil companies are paying attention. The financial markets are paying attention. How does that violence affect the global oil prices that we're seeing today?
Well, today we've got a very tight demand-supply picture. So any drop, whether it is in terms of supplies from Iraq or Nigeria or Venezuela, or for that matter from the U.S., you know, we're in the hurricane season in the Gulf of Mexico, and we know what happened a couple of years ago in that neck of the woods. And, of course, it was a great human tragedy, but it also drove oil and gas prices up substantially because refineries and oil platforms were affected and therefore also supply. So not only Nigeria, but around the world, if you've got shut-ins and shutdowns of oil pipelines, of facilities, you will see an immediate change in the price. And it's therefore a really, really big issue.
Carola, there was a headline in the FT yesterday about Nigeria erasing the expected production gain by Saudi Arabia. One of the details in that story is the quality of Nigerian crude. It's different from Saudi oil. And the fact that it's apparently low sulfur oil means that it has a bigger impact on the U.S. market than other places. Could you explain that to me?
Wow, you really have done your homework. Well done. This is a bit of a nerdy issue, but it goes right to the heart of high oil prices. Every crude oil is different. Some is more expensive and others is cheaper. The Nigerian stuff is generally very, very light, which means that refiners can quite easily refine it into gasoline and other products that we really need. They don't need very sophisticated kit to do so. And that's the kind of oil we don't have very much of. In fact, there's pretty much plenty of crude oil of the heavier kind floating around, even on storage tanks on ships outside Iran, for example, who can't sell it. So we really are talking about two kinds of products. And so it's a double whammy that not only have we lost supply in Nigeria, but we've lost supply of exactly the kind of stuff that we really want and need now. And so there you've got the dichotomy. Saudi Arabia has a lot of very nice crude oil, but its spare capacity is the kind of crude oil that is heavier, more difficult to refine. So what you're doing, what you have is an imperfect substitution. You have the Nigerian loss and the substitution from Saudi Arabia, which is not the same kind of crude oil.
And the Nigerian loss, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of barrels less a day. What is the government in Nigeria doing, and what is the oil companies doing?
Well, it's very difficult for both the oil companies and the government. I think this has been a quagmire that has taken decades for Nigeria to fall into. Nigeria is very much the poster child of the oil curse. It's a big country with a big population, so it's always been a more difficult place to operate. But for example, an oil company, the big oil companies there are Shell, Chevron, and Eni. So you've got a Dutchman, an American, and an Italian. And on the one hand, they pay very large sums of money to the Nigerian government. They can't check whether that money ends up being spent on social issues, as governments should spend oil money, or whether that money gets funneled to a Swiss bank account to fund the private education of a corrupt individual. So it's quite difficult for an oil company to move in that space. In fact, so difficult that some people have said, why you shouldn't be in Nigeria at all, because you're just making things worse. The problem with that is if oil companies were to pull out of Nigeria completely, it would be an absolute catastrophe for the oil price and the markets. Oil would move up very, very quickly. And in terms of the government, I mean, they've never had an easy job, but at the same time, they're not helped by the fact that people like Transparency International rate them very, very low on in terms of corruption.
It's a tough one. Carola Hoya, thank you. Carola Hoya is the chief energy correspondent for the Financial Times. We have more headlines for you from Femi Okeh. Good morning, Femi.
Good morning. 21 minutes to the hour. 4 Americans and 6 Iraqis have been killed by a bomb in Baghdad's Sadr city. The UN has condemned Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe's government for violence in the country's presidential runoff election. Israeli forces have killed 2 Palestinians during a raid in the West Bank city of Nablus, and this comes on the 6th day of the truce between Israel and Hamas. The Senate considers a plan today that could help hundreds of thousands of homeowners avoid foreclosure. But there are disputes among Democrats over key details, like how to actually pay for the plan. And a veto threat for the White House is predicted to delay any final agreement until at least July. Afghanistan's Taliban earned more than $100 million from the opium trade last year, according to the head of the United Nations Anti-Narcotics Agency. Senators John McCain and Barack Obama are talking energy and the environment today. Obama is in Las Vegas and McCain is in Santa Barbara, California. And a top NASA scientist and global warming expert, James Hansen, told Congress yesterday that without drastic action to combat climate change, and I quote, "we're toast," end of quote. Hansen told the congressional panel that the world has surpassed the dangerous level for greenhouse gases. Hansen is often called the godfather of global warming science. He first spoke to the Senate publicly about global warming back in 1988.
When we were pre-toast.
We were bread and now we're toast.
Hansen is one of the few scientists who can create a headline just by showing up at a hearing. Thank you, Femi. Okay.
You're very welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Adora Udoji.
Stephen Dubner, what boring economic story started the Cold War?
What boring economic story
boring
started the Cold War?
Economic dispute started the Cold War. You don't know? Well, you can be forgiven. 60th anniversary today of the incident that many historians regard as the beginning of the Cold War, the start of the blockade of Berlin. At the end of World War II, Berlin was split into 4 zones, the U.S., Britain, France, and the Soviet Union. The Allies upset Joseph Stalin with a plan to convert the worthless old German Reichmark into the Deutschmark. It was about currency conversion.
Can't believe I forgot that.
Stalin didn't want currency reform. He wanted to keep the German currency weak, and he controlled access to Berlin because Berlin was way inside East Germany. The Soviets responded by cutting off all the roads and railways into the western part of the city.
And Stalin hoped that depriving the Allied powers of food and fuel would force them to leave Berlin. 2.5 million civilians were trapped along with Allied troops, and it wasn't just difficult for Berliners to get food, Stephen. It was dangerous. The BBC's Richard Sharp was there in West Berlin in 1948.
I met a woman on the platform of a railway station here who'd been collecting fresh fruit from the Russian zone. When coming back from the Russian zone, all identity cards were inspected. All people who had B on their cards lost their fruit and were taken under arrest. B on a Berliner's card means that he or she is living in one of the Western, the non-Russian sectors. And this woman said, "My son, who tried to escape, was captured by the Russian police when he was climbing over a fence."
Stories like that suggested to the Western powers that Stalin could win. The Allied response to the blockade was Operation Vittles, one of the most ambitious humanitarian operations in history. A round-the-clock assembly line of civilian aircraft delivering flour, meat, milk, vegetables, coal, even chocolate. Here's the BBC's Richard Sharp again.
While one aircraft is landing them, another is circling the airfield preparing to land, and yet another is a black speck rapidly becoming bigger against the grey sky over the pine trees. When I was there today, a row of German civilian lorries 80 yards long was waiting to take the food into Berlin, and taken, it should be emphasized, into either British, American, or French sectors.
A plane landed every 90 seconds. The schedule was so tight that each pilot only had one chance to land. German troops would hustle the supplies off the plane and then deliver them to civilians, and a lot of people were floored by the operation's efficiency. Sir Brian Robertson was the commander of the Allied Control Council.
One thing that impresses me very much is the way the pilots and the crew are going about their work. And the German workers, too, they're doing splendidly. Of course, one would expect that. They know how very important it is. I don't think the people of Berlin will ever forget or ever forgive the days of this blockade of Berlin.
You'll appreciate this, Stephen. Operation Vittles was a success. It was all about delivering commodities at the right time, at the right place. But the Cold War had just begun. It would last a half century. The Western powers had the capacity to continue deliveries indefinitely. Stalin backed down, and the blockade was lifted in 1949.
Good stuff.
It's interesting.
Currency triggered by a currency change. Obviously, the German Reich currency was no good anymore.
Well, and it's something that George Soros obviously believes in. I mean, there are people who watch currency as an indicator of world economic health more closely than anything else.
Little historical fact. Tempelhof Airport, which was the place where the flights were shuttled in and out, is going to close at the end of October this year.
60 years later.
The Berlin blockade, 60 years later.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everybody. Lots on the table this morning. Stephen Dubner is with us. We've been talking about infuriating lies that you tell that you don't have to tell. 877-8-MY-TAKE is the place to join that conversation. Also, in Congress, they're debating an old principle in the United States, compensating U.S. veterans and people who fight American wars with educational benefits. That's a debate in Congress.
Brian Knudsen, you there?
Yes.
You're a veteran, sir.
Yes, ma'am.
How important is going to college for your family?
I found out after I transitioned from the Marine Corps that it was extremely important to get a well-paying job, a good-paying job.
And what are you studying now?
Right now I'm currently studying business management.
And are you getting any help under the current GI Bill?
Right now I'm getting a little bit of help. I'm getting roughly $1,200 a month to go to my school, and it's helping out a little bit.
Brian, hold on with us for a second, will you?
Certainly.
Edward Humes is joining us. He's the author of Over Here, How the GI Bill Transformed the American Dream. Good morning, Edward.
Good morning.
And the GI Bill that you're talking about is not the benefits that Mr. Knudsen is looking forward to here. It's actually the bill that transformed American society after World War II. Explain how important that bill was.
Well, much of what we take for granted today in America that's good, widespread college education, the home ownership as a majority entitlement, all of that arose out of the extremely forward-thinking and generous benefits that World War II veterans returned to after the war, and that they didn't really expect until they got home and found them waiting for them.
And what were the benefits that were available to World War II vets? And we should note that it wasn't a volunteer army then. It was a draft army, so it was much more widespread in the U.S., and the numbers were bigger. But what were the benefits?
Well, the benefits were the ability to get a very unusual, for that era, home loan that actually made it less expensive to buy a home than to rent an apartment, which completely reversed where most members of that generation were before the war. It enabled a veteran to go to any college in America that would accept them and essentially get a free ride for tuition, for books, for living expenses, a stipend to live off of, more money if you had dependents to support them. It was actually encouraging folks for whom college had never been on the radar screen to take advantage of furthering their education. And they went on, of course, to become the warriors in the Cold War. They became the generation that put together the mission to the moon and the information age and pretty much the modern medical system that we have in place.
This is Stephen Dubner. How did the tuition help go away? How did it get whittled away over the years?
A couple ways. With each successive conflict and generation of veterans, the benefits got progressively less generous. And then, of course, the cost of education continued to rise, and the GI Bill benefit didn't keep pace. So under the current benefits available to veterans, the average public university education is not covered. And in fact, there's a payroll deduction that servicemen and servicewomen have to pay for 12 months, $100 a month, just to qualify for any education benefit.
Brian Knudsen, how much of a sacrifice is it for you going to school under the old GI Bill? You've just heard Ed Humes talk about how much things have deteriorated over the last few decades.
Well, it's a huge sacrifice for me. I have one son, and I have another one on the way in a few weeks here. I also work over 40 hours a week in order to support my family, and that time and the money that it costs for me outside of the GI Bill to go to school I would never go. I would never be able to go without a little bit of help from the GI Bill and from an employer who's very generous as well.
We should add that you are a veteran of both the Iraq and Afghanistan wars.
Just Operation Iraqi Freedom and Enduring Freedom of Iraq.
Ed Humes, how did the GI Bill become such a central principle in American politics? I mean, there is a debate on Capitol Hill right now about the details of these benefits, but you say GI Bill to most Americans and they go, wow, that was totally good. It's almost a mom and apple pie kind of a principle. How did it get that way?
Well, it's true, but the irony is that in the form that it originally passed, it probably wouldn't have a snowball's chance of becoming law in today's political climate. What we're really talking about is giving an incredible investment in the future of a whole generation. One in eight Americans living at the time of World War II served in the military. So when you are imagine someone rising up in Congress and saying, well, we're going to give an entire generation free college education, not just veterans. I mean, just say what it really was then, an entire generation. And the reason that was done was not to benefit the military, not to encourage recruitment or retention or the other things that are being talked about in the current debate about the GI Bill. The simple idea was to invest in the future of the men and women who were returning from service in that year and to end a pattern that had existed before that where veterans were not treated well after the wars, beginning with the Revolutionary War and the Continental Congress reneging on a promise of pensions and bonuses that that enlistees had been given to sign up in during the war with Great Britain.
Edward, let's talk about the latest GI Bill, because it certainly is hoping to deliver more money and more benefits to Afghanistan and Iraq veterans. The discussion at this point is that it would double the present value of educational benefits from $40,000 to over $90,000. And it would increase the number of veterans who would be eligible for this long-term help. Is that not so?
Absolutely, yes. That's been something of a battle, because there was a concern expressed by the Pentagon and the Bush administration that if we give such a generous benefit to our veterans, it would discourage reenlistments. But the reality is that in its current form, a majority of veterans who are eligible to take advantage of those veterans' educational benefits aren't pursuing them because it's just not enough and it's too hard for them. You heard the Brian's situation. It's a very difficult commitment for him, and not everyone can do that.
Right, and as you were saying, I guess the takeaway is as we say goodbye to you, and I want to get one more question to Brian Knudsen. Edward, this bill is not transformative. It's compensatory. We're basically giving benefits to veterans in a volunteer army. We're not transforming an entire generation, which is what the GI Bill originally did. Edward, thanks so much for giving us some insight on that.
My pleasure.
Edward Humes is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, author of Over Here, How the GI Bill Transformed the American Dream. Brian Knudsen, is it enough, this new bill?
The new bill coming out, I think, is a great, great opportunity for the veterans that are out there, and it's really going to help our country and the veterans that are going to receive it.
Brian Knudsen, listen, we wish you all the very best.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. He's an Iraq veteran attending school, baby on the way.
Yeah, working 40 hours a week.
Yeah, and you have a son. All right, good for you.
Stephen Dubner, what do you make of the transformative qualities of the GI Bill? Something that affected 1 in 8 people. Can you imagine Congress doing something like that, of that economic scale today?
No, but I think it's worth looking back at the past. You know, there have been some economists who've looked at the GI Bill and its impact on society. Housing had a bigger bang than education. In other words, the education gains were not as large as our memory would like to tell us. Also, they were very segregated. Mm-hmm. African Americans in the U.S., returning veterans in the Northeast, did pretty well. Elsewhere, almost no gain from the GI Bill. I think it's also worth connecting part of the GI Bill to the housing crisis today. Not only were there zero interest loans, they taught Americans about home ownership, but there was so
and
much.
Some of those myths are being unpacked in this current crisis. Is that what you're saying?
Well, that's right. There was so much to learn from balancing a checkbook to having a mortgage that there was a group called the National Council for Economic Education founded itself to help returning GIs figure out basic financial literacy. Our financial literacy in this country is so bad and has gotten so much worse that now the NCEE teaches all the way down to the elementary school, hoping to get people to understand personal finance. And yet,
now we learn everything from DITEC.
Well, our condition is so pathetic, really, that if you look at the housing crisis, a lot of it is basic misunderstanding of what credit is.
Stephen Dubner, thank you very much. Stephen Dubner teaches us everything about economics, or should we call it Freakonomics? He writes the Freakonomic blog for the New York Times. Keep your responses coming to anything you heard on today's show. As far as lies are concerned, Tobia says, I only deliberately lied at an exit poll. She wanted to change the statistics.
And some people even called about lying.
Good morning. This is Troy Erickson calling from Grand Forks, North Dakota. And I am sad to report that I lie in the form of subtle exaggerations and embellishments. And I think I've had this trait all my life, that I just always want to have something interesting to say.
That's Troy from Grand Forks, North Dakota, Dora.
Yes.
I mean, he calls us all the time.
And so, we like it.
So all the things he said are little exaggerations and lies? No, Troy, say it isn't so.
We're on YouTube, iTunes, and Facebook. Join the discussion any way you want. 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org.
That's The Takeaway.
All right, I did lie about that.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour.
There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.